Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
Someone to come to my house immediately.
Okay, what's going on over there?
Well, my sister's been missing for 4 or 5 days. Her and her boyfriend. And we just found 2 bags in the shed. And I think they're in the shed in a bag, okay? And I'm just scared to open it.
Okay, we don't want to talk anything, okay? Because if it is something like that, there's going to be evidence, okay?
We stopped.
Okay,
we stopped.
You said there's how many bags in that shed?
There's like 5 bags, but these 2 are the ones with flies all over them, okay? Can you just get someone here to check, please?
Yep, we're getting everyone on the way. What's your name?
Kevin Marzeka. Get over here, please.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case is one that when I heard about it, I just needed to know more. Families are such complex organisations, aren't they? Every single one of you right now will be able to empathise with the fact that every single one of us has struggles in our families. Sometimes they last forever, sometimes they're temporary, sometimes they just carry on rumbling underneath the surface ad infinitum until we take our last breaths. And yes, a lot of us are blessed with close families, but that doesn't mean that there are not problems within them. But whoa. When I look at a case like the Modjeska case, it makes me go, how on earth do people arrive at such points and positions that ultimately are deadly on a range of levels? And how did those around the individuals, both the predator and the victims, not see what was going to play out? Because that's the thing, isn't it? So often we trust people in our lives and then like a bolt out of the blue, everything changes. Honestly, today's case examples that perfectly. Before I start getting into the details of this, just want to shout out that for those of you who are supporting me on my YouTube membership on Patreon, I hope you're enjoying all your extra full-length videos. I also love on those channels that I don't have to worry about the community guidelines as I do here. So if you do want more of my content, you can pop over and sign up there. And thanks to all of you who support me, because without you, I could not do this. Also, thank you to everybody in America and Canada, as well as obviously the UK, etc., who have been buying my The Serial Killer Next Door book. You are awesome. Thank you so much. And I hope you're enjoying it. And I'm loving all the feedback that you are giving me. Let's go back to August 2018. This is when Danielle Modjeska, age 18, was living with her 2 brothers and her father in a mobile home at Rudgate. That's in Clinton Mobile Home Village near to Groesbeck and 16 Mile Road in Michigan. She was also living with her boyfriend, Seren Bryan, who was aged 19. He'd also recently just moved in. They were a very close couple. But as we can understand, it's pretty difficult getting your own place when you're 19 and 18 years of age. Economically, you won't be thriving, and being able to stay together often means sharing another familial home or sharing with friends. And in this case, they'd opted to stay with family.
Now, she had a half-brother, and she also had two full siblings. And I would say the family had a few issues in general. One of the things that was problematic for the family was that they really did struggle to stay in one place for very long periods of time. It feels as if the family genuinely had some financial issues. We get to the 22nd of August, 2018. At this point, Danielle and Seren, they've been working the night shift at National Coney Island. They've been working with a friend of Danielle's, a girl called Krishinda Worley. Now, because Danielle and Seren didn't actually have their own vehicle, Krishinda would actually drive them to and from their place of work. So on August the 22nd, 2018, the three of them go to work. It's around 9 p.m. They're doing the late shift. And Krishinda drops Danielle and Seren off at home around 8 a.m. the following morning. So that's August the 23rd, 2018. Now, when she drops them off, and it's at this point that she actually noticed the white work van that was outside that belonged to Robert Sr., so Danielle's father. Now, he leaves work around 8:15 a.m. He says goodbye to Danielle, and this is literally the last time that Danielle and Seren are actually seen, because they just seem to disappear off the face of the earth. Now, the following morning, Krishinda actually sends a text message to Danielle because she's wondering where she is, but she doesn't hear back. Now, this is really, really rare. It's really unusual because, like most teenagers, Danielle is practically glued to her phone. I mean, it's your everything. It's your diary. It's your computer. It's the way that you keep your social calendar going. And young people tend to have it on them. It is literally glued to them. And she would even carry her charger around to make sure that she would be able to have charge when she needed it. Krishinda also tries to call her again because she's thinking to herself, this is really out of the ordinary. I've texted her. Now I'm calling her. She's not physically responding. She's not replying and she's not answering my calls. Then that night, when Danielle and Seren actually failed to show up for their work shift, this is really concerning because it's not the way they are. Danielle and Seren are young people, and we understand that when you're young, you maybe don't have the responsibility factor that you will do 10 years down the line. But these two are responsible. They're intelligent, they're articulate, they're creative, they're artistic. They're really great kids. And that means that people who know them have an expectation level of their behaviour, and this is falling short of that expected behaviour. So the next day, so this is around 5 p.m, Krishinda, who is clearly the most amazing friend, because I often think that so often people disappear, and yeah, people talk about they're wondering where they are and they're concerned about what might be happening to them, but they don't necessarily take any action. Quite the contrary, where Krishinda is concerned. She goes to Danielle's home, she goes...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
To check on her, because she's thinking, this is weird. She's obviously hoping for the best, but also fearing the worst. Now, Robert Sr. and Robert Jr. were actually at home. Now, Robert Sr. had issues. He was somebody who was a drinker and he was intoxicated. Initially, wouldn't let her in the house. But at some point, Robert Jr. gets up and leaves in the work van. Now, bear in mind, this is a little bit strange because there are two people missing. You have a father who's intoxicated and is not being very helpful. You have a brother who just seemingly has got up and left. And no one's really recognizing how notable the absence of two people that people should be concerned about is going. Nobody seems to be concerned. Now, Krishinda, on the other hand, is. She stays until about 8 p.m. and then she has to leave for work. But now the dread is building. So she returns around 5 a.m. the next morning. She's not having it. She's thinking to herself, nobody seems to be bothered about these two incalculably important human beings in my life. The family aren't doing anything. I'm going to have to make somebody take some action. So at this point, she literally wakes up the still drunken Robert Sr. and she has an argument with him. At this point, she gets him in a vehicle, drives into the police station and says, we are reporting the couple as missing. You wouldn't imagine that should be the driving force of their friend. It should be the driving force of the family. But again, that gives us an invitation to some degree as to the relationships that are going on within that family unit, because they're acting in an atypical manner. Now, on the 25th of August, Clinton Township Police then received that missing persons report. This is from Robert Sr. And he tells the police that basically Danielle and Seren are missing. He says, look, the last time I remember seeing them was the morning of the 23rd of August. At first, what the family and friends of Danielle and Seren try to do is to minimise. They try to think to themselves, listen, we're probably overreacting. These are young people. These kind of things happen. Maybe they've just gone off grid. Maybe they've just decided to take themselves off on a road trip. They're going to turn up eventually. Because apparently in the past, Danielle had done things like that. She was quite a free spirit. I think it went with her artistic nature. And she would just disappear for several hours, sometimes for a whole day. But there is something distinct even in comparing those kind of disappearances to what they're dealing with now. And that is that she's just not active on Facebook or Messenger. And she always would be during those periods when she went off doing something else. Also, she always had a phone. So she had the phone. She had the phone charger. She's essentially ignoring everybody, which is very distinct to her normal behaviour. Also, the couple's friends start really asking around, pleading for information, because they don't know where to start. They don't know what could possibly have happened. So they go on social media, but nobody is saying they've seen them. Nobody's seen them walking down the road. Nobody's seen them at an activity center. No one's seen them passing them on the street. They just seem to have vanished. And those days, they continue to pass. And again, Danielle and Seren remain inactive on Facebook. Moreover, all of the belongings that they would have taken with them should they have decided to go on some kind of long road trip, well, they all remain inside their shared bedroom. Now, what those who knew Danielle found really suspicious was that Danielle didn't only leave behind all of her clothing, but she also left behind her necklaces. And those necklaces were incredibly important to her because they belonged to her mother, Jill. And Jill had actually passed away of a drugs overdose back in 2011. They were incredibly sentimental to her. She wore them wherever she went. And there were also some really peculiar differences in the actual bedroom. So, for example, the pillows and the blankets were actually missing. And there was a blue sheet on the top of the bed that had never even been seen there before. Not by any of the family members, not by any of the friends who knew the couple. Now, Kevin, he went ahead and searched his sister's bedroom. And he said, look, my sister's bedroom's always messy. You know, she's a normal teenager, but this just does not look like the normal mess. There just seems like something's a little bit off. And he genuinely started to have this feeling of dread. He felt that something bad could have happened. And because of that, he starts to think to himself, I'm going to go and look for traces of blood. Maybe there's some drag trails, just something that would make me feel something bad had happened to my sister or my sister's boyfriend. Now, over the past couple of days, something strange had been occurring. There'd been this really foul odour coming from the shed in the backyard. And that smell eventually became way too much to bear. And we all know what we're talking about, aren't we? When we're actually able to connect with a scent that feels so diabolical, so vulgar, so warning-based to some degree, that it's meant to make us averse, it's meant to make us back away because potentially there's danger there. That's the smell that's occurring in that moment. But that smell is so overpowering, so overwhelming, that finally they can't ignore it. So on the 26th of August, 14-year-old Kevin decided that he needed to investigate the source of the smell. Now, bear in mind, the family at this point had been believing that it was likely down to an animal. You know, an animal's crawled into the shed, it's died, it's not been able to get out, or maybe it went in there because it was sick and eventually it started to rot. So Kevin and Robert Sr. end up going into the shed. As soon as the shed door is opened, the swarm of flies is everywhere. You can just imagine the smell and then the noise and the buzz in the heat, the grotesque reality of what they're staring at. and that appalling odour just hits Kevin in the face. He actually stumbles backwards, then he's looking back into that shed with that horror, that knowledge something really bad has played out here. Kevin then begins to move the lawnmower out of the way, and then suddenly there ahead of him, two giant black contractor bags. He hadn't put them in there. He didn't know how they'd arrived there. As far as he was concerned, it was nothing to do with himself or his family members. But it's evident immediately that the source of that smell, the source of that grotesque odour, was coming from those two large black contractor's bags that were on the floor of the shed. He said, "When I found the bags, my heart sank. We were hesitant to even approach the bags, so there were flies on them. We kind of figured what the source of flies would be about. We argued about it for 5 minutes, who was going to open it or look into it, and neither of us could do it. So eventually my dad, you know, he always carries a razor knife on him, so he took it and he sliced open one of the bags. And from there, I could see a pale, veiny leg. It's what I believed I'd seen at least." Father and son at this moment in time are absolutely horrified, because let's be real, you have two people missing from the family. Now you've got two large contractor bags at the back of a shed that stinks of decomposition, decay, and now you've seen a human leg. It goes without saying, the adding up to the recognition that they have found their missing family members is going to be profound for them. Now they don't go any further. They do the right thing. They back away. They immediately call the police, just sitting on the porch waiting for them to arrive. And Robert Sr. just keeps repeating to his son, "Tell me it's not her." And Kevin said, "I called the police department and I told them that they needed to get here. I was pretty sure I found a dead body in my shed." So everything has changed in that moment. They are breathtakingly blindsided, not just from the smell, the flies, the horror, but for all that slow dawning recognisation and realisation that it is likely Danielle and Saren in that shed. Now, the first officer on the scene, Officer Stephen Vasildes, he described the search of the shed, saying, "I didn't even step all the way into it. I could smell a very strong odour, an odour I've smelled before. A decomposing person." And that's what investigators say. They say that whilst they smell lots of different types of decay, obviously animals that have come to their end and so on and so forth, it is so distinct from human decay. We're hardwired to smell human decay in a way that's distinct, because it reminds us, do not go any further, because bad things could happen to us. If somebody has died there, that could mean that our life were also at risk. So these investigators, they know that smell. He also said there were a lot of flies in the area. The doors were already open at that point, and there'd actually been some mattresses and stuff in the area that had been moved out of the way. He said there were bags and all kinds of other things from a home that they were just piled up on the sides. And there was basically this aisleway in the centre when it came down to the shed. And the bags that were in question, they were in the rear corner. So if you're looking into the shed, they were on the left-hand side there. And just by seeing it in the area that was exposed, you could just tell it was a decomposing body. On the right-hand side of the photograph, when they looked at the images that had been taken, you could actually see a better image of the body that had been in the bag that was cut open. And there was another bag next to it in a similar type position. In one of the bags, they found the body of Danielle. In the other, they found the body of Saren, and it was horrific. They'd both been bound with duct tape around their wrists and ankles, and it was also found wrapped around their heads. What a horrific way to die. As soon as it starts being reported that Danielle and Saren were deceased, some people who knew them started to suggest that maybe they'd taken their own lives. I mean, I think they must not have had all of the information, because as I've just described it to you, these people were duct taped and they were placed in bags. They're not Houdini. They could not have done that themselves. But rumours were going around saying that both Danielle and Saren had posted some dark things on social media, including one post where they both talked about overdosing. Now, let's be clear, 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds are and live in fantasy lands at times. And also, they expressed themselves in a range of ways. Saren was an incredibly gifted artist, so he's somebody who would likely draw things that were dark from time to time. This is not indicative of people who want to take their own lives. And talking about overdosing is not the same as an action of overdosing. In fact, what we often do as we grow through the ages psychologically is we test our boundaries. And the tests that we give ourselves are such as, could I take my own life? How would I take my own life? These are not unusual conversations and certainly do not indicate that this is what's played out. And Daniel's friend, Madassian Clark, actually said Saren always had a dark sense of humour. It was just how he was. They just liked to joke and play and talk about the darker things in life, but it was only ever messing around. And in reality, it took the police about 1 second to recognise that there was absolutely no chance whatsoever on God's earth that this was an agreed suicide scenario. It was abundantly clear it wasn't the case. For the most obvious, the couple are found stuffed inside a bag and they're hidden inside the shed. They've also been bound with duct tape, so it's impossible. Now, Dr. Mary Pietrangelo, she performed the autopsies and found out about the following. Both of the bodies had begun to decompose. They had both been bludgeoned with a Husky 27-ounce hammer. So again, immediately discounts the idea of them taking their lives willingly. They'd also been asphyxiated with the duct tape that was found wrapped around their heads. Saren Bryan was wrapped in 5 plastic bags. 3 bags were around just his head and neck. 1 bag was around his lower body and 1 bag was around his upper body. There was duct tape all over his lower mouth and the sides of his face and the back of his neck. Dr. Pietrangelo, they believe that the tape had initially been over Saren's nose at one point, but then had slipped down due to the decomposition. Saren also had 3 scalp lacerations on the back of his head from blunt force trauma. And according to Dr. Pietrangelo, these strikes occurred while Saren was alive. They would have immediately rendered him unconscious. But those final moments of consciousness must have been absolutely terrifying. And the doctor also said that those blunt force trauma injuries didn't actually kill him. Instead, the doctor determined that the cause of death was asphyxia due to suffocation. So his knees were at his chest and his arms were over his knees in the bags, and it was restricting his ability to breathe. Also, his wrists and ankles were bound separately and then held together with duct tape, holding him in that position. Danielle, she was wrapped in 3 plastic bags. 1 bag was around her whole body and 2 were around her head and neck. There was duct tape again around her head, which was also over her nostrils and her mouth. And she had duct tape around her neck. Danielle again had 7 lacerations from blunt force trauma, and these were scattered essentially across her scalp. She had several scalp fractures. And whilst the skull fractures wouldn't have actually been instantly fatal, Dr. Pietrangelo couldn't actually determine whether she died from the fractures or asphyxiation by suffocation. Again, she was...
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Position similarly to Brian. Her knees were to her chest and her ankles were bound by duct tape. Her wrists were not bound, but there was a loop of duct tape near her ankles, and that suggests that Danielle's wrists were bound there at one point. Danielle and Saren were only wearing shirts and underwear. Dr. Pietrangelo found no signs of strangulation or of defensive wounds on either of the victims, so they certainly weren't ready and prepared for an attack. But she also found that whoever had done this at no point tried to revive either of them through cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So this person wanted them dead and was happy when they were indeed dead. Now, investigators at this point are trying to piece together who the hell wants this couple dead. And also, the type of crime we're talking about, you can't help but immediately be brought into the idea that there is an intimacy relationship. Because the way they've been killed is just truly horrific. If you want to murder somebody and you're not related to them, you do it, and you likely are going to leave them in that situation. You're not going to take the amount of time that is required to do what I have told you was done to their bodies if you are trying to make an escape. This seems to be somebody who knows the environment, knows the individuals, and knows what to do with their bodies after they have killed them. So they are immediately looking in the line of the family. And it doesn't take them very long to start looking in the direction of Robert Jr. Now, Robert Jr. has caused a few eyebrows to be raised on the morning that the bodies have been found. For example, his younger brother actually calls him and tells him what's going on, and he just ceases contact with him. Now, what would you do in that situation? You find out that your sister and her boyfriend has likely been found dead in your garage. You are going to be absolutely devastated. You're going to be hot-footing at home. You're going to be trying to figure out who the hell has done this. That does not happen. So that in itself is deeply concerning. Secondly, we always look at the family first and foremost, particularly when deaths occur at the family home, because you usually find your murderer there. And we would expect innocent people to be quite happy being present. And Robert Jr. clearly isn't happy being present. So he becomes their prime suspect. This is 24-year-old Robert Leo Majeska. Clinton Township Police Detective Captain Richard Merrill actually said, "We found some initial evidence that indicated the brother may have been involved, and then some more that centred us on his involvement in the case." Now, the reason for this is some evidence that come from a neighbour of the family. They said to investigators that they'd actually seen a white male driving a moving truck over the weekend, and she'd watched as he used a dolly to transport two large objects through her yard and into the family's yard. So she believed that that man was in fact Robert Jr. Also, when they go and search the house, in Robert Jr.'s bedroom, deeply concerning things are found. So there are blood-stained items, including clothing and towels. By the way, Robert's long gone at this point. He disappeared around the same time as Danielle and Seren, to all intents and purposes, so that's incredibly concerning. And then as soon as the bodies are discovered, this is when the US Marshals decide that they need to be involved in the case because they need to find Robert Jr. Where is he? Is he armed and dangerous? Could he kill again? They announce this to the public because they want them all looking out, both for Robert Jr. and also for the car he's driving, for his Ford 1999 E250 van. This is missing along with him. Now, Robert's former employer, he was actually in the process of selling that van to Robert and his father, Robert Sr., but recently, because of financial issues, they stopped making the payments, so it was becoming a bit of a problem. He would want his van back. Now, Robert Jr. and Robert Sr. were both working as painting subcontractors. And sometimes also, when the family will earn money, Kevin, one of the brothers, would also work alongside them. And Robert's employer was a good guy, but obviously had lent them this van and wanted it back because they'd stopped making the payments on it. So he was scheduled to pick it up so he would get it back because they weren't coming good on the agreements that they'd made with each other. Now, he's informed by the investigators at that point, "Well, the problem with your van is it's missing and it has somebody that we believe is a wanted felon on the run in it." So at this point, the employer gave a lot of details and description about the van. Also commented in the media that one of the things that he tried to do was to help out the family, and he felt that they were struggling financially. He said that they seemed like really good people. He noted that Robert Sr. did have a really big problem with alcohol, but he wasn't violent in any way, and so he genuinely felt sorry for them and wanted to do them a good turn. Now, when it was announced that Robert Jr. was the lead suspect in his sister and Seren's murder, those who knew the family were literally stunned. They were blindsided. Now, there were some people who said, "Listen, looking back, when you actually have the information that you have in the moment, you can say maybe there were some warning signs. Maybe there was something that was a little bit off in the dynamic and in the household." So Madison, she told investigators that just a couple of weeks before Danielle vanished, she'd actually confided in her other friends that there were some incidents where Robert had made her feel really uncomfortable, and that it wasn't like genuine sibling rivalry. It was darker. There was something really uncomfortable about the interactions that had occurred. Robert had apparently been suffering quite seriously with issues for a very long time. Much of these were to do with mental illness, and he had this real downward spiral that began following the tragic death of his mother in 2011. Now, Robert was 17 years of age at that point, and we all understand when stress is high, mental illness can also be exacerbated if you have a predisposed mental illness or you're suffering one. And then you go through these horrible times, understandably, it can amplify some of the symptoms. Now, shortly after she died, Robert actually started to hear voices. He also began to act quite peculiarly. So we're talking about hallucinations that are auditory, and also just the actions that suggest maybe he was being suspicious or paranoid. So there is something unraveling. And on the way home from his mother's funeral, he actually began quoting Bible verses to his aunt Deborah Scatella. He was telling her that she should smoke marijuana. So he's acting in a way that just doesn't seem in context with typical behaviour, particularly when it comes down to that religious scenario playing out, suddenly starting to quote scripture. If it's not something that person does on a regular basis, it tends to be a bit of a warning sign, unless you are, of course, becoming invested in following Christianity. I mean, a lot of people do that. But when it's out of the blue and when it connects with a highly stressful period, such as grief, we do have to look at that as a red flag. Also, the fact that he's telling her she should be smoking marijuana indicates he is. And again, if you have a predisposition for mental illness, and I know some people out there will say, well, no, I have medical marijuana for my mental illness. I appreciate there are different spectrums and different treatments, but I can tell you, if you are smoking street grade stuff, you are smoking stuff that is way strong and often does not have the right kind of THC levels or the right kinds of kindling balls in it that essentially can make a difference on a positive level to your mental health. It can do the very opposite. So he's probably smoking a lot of weed. He's self-medicating with it, and self-medicating it to probably manage his mental health. Now, that same year, Robert is diagnosed with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and paranoia. And over the fourth coming years, he was hospitalized several times due to his erratic behavior. But despite this diagnosis, which is quite a serious diagnosis, he just could not get his head around the fact that anything was wrong with him. And when he was prescribed medication, he would refuse to take it. This is really common. And people will say, well, hey, we all have autonomy of choice. Why should I have to take this medication? Just because somebody prescribes it for me doesn't mean that I have to take it. At the end of the day, they make me feel woozy, or I don't like the way that I feel, or I feel like I lose myself. These are very common conversations that I've had with very many people over the years in this work. But it also speaks of suspicion. It also speaks of paranoia. Because often what happens, particularly if you're somebody developing schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, your belief system is that people are trying to poison you, or that people are trying to do bad things to you. And therefore, the medication becomes a weapon against you in your mindset. And it would make sense that he's resistant because potentially, yes, he thinks he doesn't need it, or because he believes that by taking it, he will be under threat. Others will be trying to control him. And that can lead to a resentfulness with him. It genuinely can, because you feel other people are trying to exert power over you when they have absolutely no right to do so. Now, the medications that he was meant to take included Seroquel and lithium, and he's not taking that medication. So we get to 2015, and at this point, Robert's listed as a mentally ill person, and there's actually a petition to have him involuntarily committed to a psychiatric hospital. Dr. Bazifi Badangam actually saw Robert and went ahead and wrote in the documents, he threatens suicide and is aggressive towards others. He is hyperverbal with pressured speech. He has hallucinations and paranoid ideation. He has no insight. Now that's a heavy, heavy description. He's saying this individual is not insightful whatsoever about his emotional being. Now that report has got some deeply, deeply troubling information in it. The idea that, first of all, he has paranoid ideation. Paranoid ideation means that the way that he's seeing the world is through a paranoid lens. It doesn't matter that everybody around them is saying, no, Robert, none of that is making sense. All that will do is play into the fact that, no, I need to be super paranoid because I know what's going on and you're trying to tell me that things aren't going on, which makes you somebody that I have to be deeply suspicious of. It's a really, really vicious cycle. Also, this doctor says, this man has no insight. So insight is when we are able to sit with our feelings. They may be very, very different to the feelings of another person. We may be going on a psychological decline, but when we sit with another human being and they are able to ask us about our feelings, we are able to look internally and describe what we believe is going on. And when they respond to us about their feelings, and that might illuminate further our own insight, we're able to hold their view and our view on a level where we respect differences of opinions and we respect professional insights that we might not other have if we weren't having those conversations. And that makes us feel that we have an understanding of how we are, why we are, and where we are, even if it doesn't make it feel easier that we are going through it. But this guy has no insight whatsoever. And we also know that he's saying he doesn't want to be here, he's threatening to take his own life, he's threatening other people. And when they talk about being hyperverbal with pressured speech, it means that everything is going so fast. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to make sense, but it's making sense to them. And so I would say this is a very high level decline in his mental health. And arguably some treatment, potentially even inpatient treatment, should have occurred when you read what I've just read that that doctor said. But this petition is dismissed. Now, in the end, another one is filed. This is when he's described as potentially harmful to himself and to others. Erin Funk, the girlfriend of Daniel's other brother Kevin, she'd filed the petition because there had been some really disturbing incidents at the family home. She'd actually written that Robert had been physically fighting with his brothers and his father, and he would just frequently kick in the bedroom door, which clearly shows a lack of boundary. I often think that when we are living in high stress situations, we get used to these kind of scenarios. I've worked with so many families who have been dealing with very dysfunctional teenagers, and I've also worked with women in particular who've dealt with unbelievably violent men in their lives. And what happens is they see objects separately to themselves. So when a man starts coming for you and you hide behind a door and then he kicks the door in, but he doesn't hit you, you see that as an object and you say to yourself, ah, if he'd really wanted to hurt me, he'd have punched me. He'd not have kicked the door in. No, it's not true. What happened in that moment is he had a huge amount of cortisol rushing through his brain. The adrenaline was pumping. You're hiding, so he knows you're scared. He knows he's got power over you. He knows there's nowhere you can go. So when he bashes the door down, he gets that level of calm because he's externalized all of that adrenaline and cortisol. And then he's seen the look on your face and it's warning enough. Door this time, you next time. So when these kind of actions occur, what tends to happen is we minimize them. It was just a door. It was just a wall. But it's actually an incremental building to what will be physical violence to you. Now, Robert seems to be increasing in his aggressiveness. He's going out of his way to start fights that are completely unwarranted with his family. And this particular girlfriend of one of his brothers has actually written that he refuses to shower. He's stopped caring about his physical appearance. And we understand that when people are declining in their mental health, again, physical appearance suffers. Now, once that petition's filed, Robert was actually seen by a psychiatrist and he wrote in a certification that he may harm himself or others and that he was also extremely suspicious, paranoid and impulsive, exactly the same as the prior psychiatrist. Two other psychiatrists, somebody called Dr. Ken Andrews and Dr. Dale Scarlett, they indicated, however, that Robert did not have to be hospitalized. In fact, he required alternative treatments such as outpatient care. Dr. Scarlett had actually written that Robert had a history of bipolar disorder and that he denied having depression as well as denying being suicidal or having homicidal thoughts, as well as denying having psychosis. Now, I would say, having lived this both on a professional level and in a personal level where psychosis is concerned, it is definitely better if psychosis can be managed at home, because psychosis is absolutely destabilizing for the people who are suffering it. It's terrifying. You hear things, see things, feel things, smell things. And if you are in a foreign place surrounded by foreign people and you're dealing with higher level suspicion and paranoia, understandably, that is going to contribute to making you feel even worse. So we absolutely, pathway wise, want to get people who are going through psychotic breaks home with people who love them, make them feel safe, offer them familiarity, and hopefully cradle them through the period of psychosis, as long as they're not really dangerous. But this guy has expressed that he is quite dangerous. There have been psychiatrists who believe that he is, in fact, as he says, dangerous, and yet for whatever reason, now apparently is denying having these thoughts. They're like, okay, let's get him home. Also, it's worth noting, home was not exactly where the heart is.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Is in this family dynamic. In fact, it was so hostile in that home that Kevin, one of the brothers, would often stay over with his girlfriend, Erin, because he felt safe there. And I would say he had a very good instinct in these matters. Now, despite the problems, those in the family who lived there said there was never any prior violent incidents between Danielle and Robert. Kevin said that he could indeed recall one incident when they disagreed over a cat apparently they were both caring for. Daniel was really upset that Robert wouldn't open his bedroom door when she wanted him to care for the cat. But apparently it wasn't too explosive. It wasn't something that really got out of hand. And it was the same for Seren as well. Apparently there were never any real incidents that made the family scared that Robert was capable of hurting him. Kevin actually recalled that there was an incident back in 2017. This is when Robert believed that Seren had made some kind of negative comment about his deceased mother. And he hadn't. He was actually talking about a documentary about mothers. And even though that escalated, the situation was quickly diffused. So what the family are saying is, yeah, there may be a level of toxicity in our home, but it's not completely atypical to other people's situations. And with respect, when it comes down to arguments happening, they're resolved quickly. They're resolved without violence. So there was nothing too extreme. Now, there are other reports that suggest that Robert Jr. was very jealous of Danielle. That there was something about her that provoked him. She was a beautiful, creative, very captivating young woman. And it could be that he saw in her talents that he didn't hold. And of course, she was in love. She was in love with Seren and her life was beginning, and they were talking about escaping where they were living, and maybe that was a trigger. Maybe he felt he was losing control over a situation that was familiar to him and he didn't like it. Maybe he saw Seren as the enemy because he was like the knight in shining armor arriving to take his sister away from the situation that he too wished to escape from. Now, while Robert Sr. did have the support of his family, One of the things from the get-go was there was not very many places that he could go because he didn't have a major support network. So it's not like he can just leave the family home where all of this horror is played out. But at the same time, he couldn't return to the home of the scene of the crime because it's surrounded with crime scene tape as forensic experts are just desperately combing for clues and they want to find whoever is responsible. So his needs go to the bottom of the list. And even though he has alcohol issues and even though he's going through the horrible grief that he's going through, at the end of the day, it's not their problem. Their problem is they've got two dead bodies and they need to find out exactly who is responsible. So Robert Sr. ends up getting care from local churches, also gets help from a local funeral home. They stepped in to help him out with the funeral because he needed to plan that now. They created a GoFundMe that was established to help the family financially. And Crime Stoppers also put out a reward of $2,500 for anybody with information that could lead to Robert's arrest. And this was subsequently increased to $50,000 as for ideas to where Robert could have fled to. Bear in mind, the family are at a loss. Their whole world has just disintegrated. Everything they knew, they no longer know. Every fear they have has now been realised. And the antagonist who has caused them this pain is on the run. And they'll be bothered for him too. Because even when people in our family do things that are unspeakably evil, we can't let go of all of our feelings for them in that moment. And we have fear for them too, because what if he's going to end his life? What if they are ultimately going to face yet another loss? So the police at this point start to trawl CCTV footage to look for Robert. And they're actually very early on able to turn up CCTV footage of Robert buying a cup of coffee at Tim Horton's restaurant. This is in West Bloomfield Township. Now, bear in mind, this is shortly after the killings. He's just going and grabbing himself a coffee. Then he uses the family's work van and he flees to Toledo. Now, that van was recovered on August the 28th outside a Seaway Marketplace in Toledo Township. He then leaves the van there and goes to a Circle K convenience store nearly 3 miles away. And at that point, there's a video showing Robert wearing a blonde wig. He's also buying a fountain drink. He also tried to buy cigarettes, but he couldn't provide identification to the cashier. He's excessively searching his pockets at that point because obviously he's trying to come up with the ID or hoping that they'll relent and just give him the cigarettes. He then boards a Greyhound bus nearby and he goes to Cincinnati, and it's in Cincinnati where he's captured on August the 29th by the US Marshals Service. So even though he disguised himself, let's just say this guy stuck out like a sore thumb. And the reason he was actually caught in Cincinnati, Ohio, is because on the 30th of August, there was a woman who was approached by a man who asked if he could access the internet to play an online game. And she directed the man to the nearby library. And when he turned and walked away, she just knew. She knew it was him. So she immediately called the police. She recognized the man as Robert Jr., who was indeed wanted for double murder. Isn't it amazing when human beings have that perception? I mean, we see millions of people a day, don't we? But there was something about his image that she held in her mind. The moment he talked to her, she knew this is the guy. And because of her actions, he was swiftly brought to justice. So the US Marshals, they arrive at the library and indeed they find Robert wearing a disguise. And the disguise was pretty out there. It was a long blonde wig with a hat and sunglasses. Robert's van was then recovered, abandoned in Toledo, Ohio. He'd left the vehicle by that point and he'd travelled to Cincinnati by bus. Robert was arrested without incident, so he didn't put up any fight. He was taken by the US Marshals at this point. Police Captain Richard Merrill said, "We've got a whole case put together. There's just a lot of information we have presented to get the warrant. There's not one smoking gun. There is a whole timeline of information of different facts putting it all together." Now, the following day, Robert was charged with 2 counts of first degree murder. He appeared in court for an extradition hearing where he declined to challenge the extradition and agreed to be returned to Clinton Township to face the charges. Following that extradition, he appeared in court for the hearing and he entered a not guilty plea that was entered for him on his behalf. Robert, at that point, just appeared really dishevelled. And when he was asked whether there was anything he wanted considered in setting bail, he just responded, "No, there's not." He sat quietly through the proceedings, mostly just gave one-word answers when asked for the information. The magistrate at this point ordered Robert to be held without bond. This followed a very brief court hearing, but of course he's going to be held without bond. I mean, this is a guy who has literally brutally murdered his sister and her boyfriend for no reason. Let's be clear about this. No reason whatsoever. And then has left their rotting corpses in the family shed. This man could never be safe to walk our streets because what he's done has made no sense whatsoever. Now, understandably, the court order that he has to go through a psychiatric examination, and his defence attorney, Azra Sheikh, he requested the evaluation before the case proceeded through to the next level because, understandably, he's saying my client won't have been sane during this experience. Now, Judge Sebastian Lucido did grant the request and also referred Robert to the Centre for Forensic Psychiatry. Defence Sheikh revealed that he had actually gone ahead and visited his client in the mental health wing of the jail where he'd been staying since his extradition. And he said his client was concerned by the fact he had not received his psychiatric medication and that he had been off the medication for a while. Now, it's interesting because, as we know, one of the things that Robert Jr. didn't want to do was to take his medication. So the fact that he's annoyed he's not being given it makes a kind of hypocrisy of his prior actions. Equally, one can say, well, when you are being assessed, what will often happen is they will take you off your medication, or at least taper you off your medication to give you a period without it. And the reason for that is, how do they know how you are psychiatrically if you are medicated? I know that can be very upsetting for people, but it can also be really positive. Often what happens in life, particularly in the psychiatric system, it's one of the reasons why it's broken. It's one of the reasons why the psychological system is broken. It's because people assess, classify, medicate, and then they assess, classify, medicate. Then they assess, classify, medicate, 6 times, 7 times, 8 times, different practitioners, all coming to a different conclusion, all adding some more medication, all changing the protocol that the medication is going to be served under. And then all of a sudden you realise this person may not have half the things they're being medicated for. And the only reason that you get to grips with what's truly going on is to take them off and then watch. That's why assessments can be months long, because they need to know who is this person baseline and how are they when we try them with A, B or C. And that ideally leads to people being treated appropriately and accurately and just not overloaded with medications that could be doing more harm than good. Defence Sheikh also spoke publicly about Robert's 3 prior hospitalisations for his mental health problems. And he said, there's definitely a history there. He's got to stay focused so I can ask him questions that he can answer. And I think we all agree, there's absolutely no way that Robert Jr. is okay. Clearly, it has been noted that he's dealt with paranoia, suspicion. He's had problems in the past. There is something atypical about his mental state. But that's not an excuse for the double homicide that seems very premeditated of 2 completely innocent human beings with their lives just starting. Now, as Robert was being examined, Prosecutor Eric Smith actually spoke publicly about the number of murder suspects in the county that have been previously diagnosed with mental illness and drug issues. He said that Danielle and Seren, as well as a handful of other murder victims, would still be alive if institutions had provided proper care to their killers, including Robert Jr. He went on to say almost every homicide case that we've had in the last year, year and a half, has been referred to the forensic centre. From there, we've gotten an overwhelming number of cases back. The defendants are either not competent to stand to trial or come back insane. And it's not whether they've committed the crime, it's whether they were guilty but mentally ill, were not guilty by reason of insanity. 50 to 60% of the referrals are coming back not competent to stand trial or insane. This is from the state-sponsored forensics. This isn't forensic experts that the defence is hiring. These are the ones the state is using. It's never been that high. There is a documented history of mental illness on so many of these cases. So the clear suggestion is that things are going wrong. You know, people are seeing these individuals who are obviously struggling with mental health. intervention isn't happening in a way that protects both themselves and their future victims. And we end up in court where the court is being told this person is not competent to stand trial. This person was insane when they carried out their actions. This person has a prior mental health issue that evidences if intervention had taken place, there could have been a different outcome. And it is deeply concerning. And I guess it also has to go down to the what is going on in our society that so many people are mentally ill. What is in our water? What is in our air? What is in our food? What is in the drugs that people are taking? And I'm using those genuinely altogether. I'm not saying that plucking them out of the sky. I'm saying, what is it? What's going on in our education? What's going on in our families? Mental illness is not just an one person situation. As much as people like to see it that way, it's not an individual is mentally ill and that's it. Everything else is fine. No, that's not how it works. There's a whole heap of reasons and contributing factors that lead to mental illness. What people are putting in their body, what they're breathing into their body, the exercise that they're not doing with their body, the people they're sharing their lives with who are affecting them, their living conditions, their opportunity, the stress that they feel, all of these things contribute. And when these individuals are finding themselves in psychiatric wards being assessed by people who are saying this person is not well, they are a danger, and then they end up going home and they are in fact a danger, there is a huge problem on a range of levels, from family to experience of the individual within that network to the opportunities around them to receive help. And finally, to those red flags that are waved by the professional saying more help is needed and the help doesn't arrive. Because we're talking about lives being lost that don't need to be lost. Now, in December, Robert was back in court. He was back in court at this point for the results of his mental evaluation.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
And it was announced, of course, at this point, as we often see, that he is indeed now competent to stand trial for the double murder and that he was also culpable for his alleged actions. Now, defence Sheikh, he revealed that he was planning an insanity defence for his client. He said it was quite obvious that this was the route they were going to take from the moment that Robert's mental health history was publicised. And defence Sheikh said, our defence is going to have to be insanity because he's had episodes where he's been hospitalised, where he's been medicated, and there's absolutely zero motive. Defence Sheikh also said at this point that his client was sorry for the murders. Now, one of the things that was very obvious from the get-go in this case is there's no way that Robert could have denied what he did. You just have to think about how the bodies were found and the scene of the crime itself. Because not only do they discover the bodies in that shed, they also see that the home itself is a crime scene. So Officer Stephen Basildes, who's an evidence technician, he went into that house and just found evidence of a brutal, frenzied attack inside the family home. So investigators had actually established that Danielle and Seren were attacked in the bedroom they shared. Danielle's blood was found on the floor underneath the hamper. It was found on a vanity table, a pair of shorts, a t-shirt. Robert's blood was also found on the same pair of shorts and the t-shirt. Every single wall in the bedroom had flecks of blood on it. That includes blood spatter to the walls, a TV cabinet, and on the mattress and box spring. There was blood from Danielle, Seren, and Robert found on a roll of duct tape while Robert's fingerprints were also found on two duct tape rolls, one inside the home and another found outside, inside the shed alongside the two bodies. So he's banged to rights. Obviously, it's Robert. Now, Officer Fazildez said that there was so much blood on an empty duct tape roll, it looked as if somebody had painted it there. Oh, the idea of that coagulated blood just wrapping itself around the duct tape. It's just such a malevolent image to bring to mind. And also there was evidence that someone had actually tried to clean up the crime scene. So there were only small spots of blood that were found. Some were undetectable to the human eye. But when they actually used the application of Blue Star, it's a bit similar to Luminol. Blood smears were also found in the kitchen sink area. In fact, Ashley Motter, who's a forensic biologist with the Michigan State Police, they performed a number of DNA analyses. So they did DNA testing on the murder weapon. The hammer they found had blood on. The hammer's head had blood on from both Danielle and Seren. And also Robert's DNA was present on the handle. Then Detective Sergeant Cynthia Edwards, she was a latent print examiner for the Michigan State Department. She performed an independent verification of two fingerprints for which another examiner had already performed comparisons. One print was found on the inside of a duct tape roll and the other was on the duct tape roll. Both prints matched those of Robert. But the main part of the case evidently wasn't going to be whether Robert had carried out the murders, but instead whether he was legally insane at the time. So it's clear he did it, no doubt whatsoever, but did he know he was doing it or was he completely out of his mind? So they scheduled the trial for November of 2019. But before then, Defence Sheikh announced that he would no longer be seeking a plea of insanity. In fact, he'd hired his own forensic psychologist, somebody called Dr. Thomas Chaser, to evaluate Robert in the hopes that he would back the insanity defence up. Dr. Shaza had indeed examined Robert, but he said no. He was sane at the time of the murders. He said Robert simply didn't meet the standards of insanity or not being criminally responsible. He said that Robert appeared to fully comprehend his actions as, in the aftermath of the murders, he'd fled to Ohio. He'd donned a disguise. Hardly somebody who's out of his mind when he's thinking, I wonder what wig to wear so that people won't notice me. You know, when you were in a disorganized state when you kill people, that's because you've had that psychotic break. And of course, we're not defending people who kill people that way. They still absolutely deserve to serve a sentence of some type. But we have an understanding. Their mind was lost. This guy was somebody who had not only the wherewithal to find what he needed to murder his sister and Sarin. So not only did he bludgeon them around the head, likely when they were laid down in bed so they didn't see it coming, gave him the best chance to get away with killing them. Then he took great opportunity in providing the materials required to literally duct tape them into several bags to a point where at least one of them asphyxiated as well as was bludgeoned. He then drags them all the way to the shed, after which he cleans up the scene and then thinks to himself, you know what I need? I need to go on a bit of a road trip. I'll just get in that vehicle that isn't mine and I'll just drive, and then I'll dump my car. And you know what else I'll do? I'll put a wig on. I'll put a long wig on and I shall be fine and I shall just move on with my life. That's not how somebody who is in serious mental decline acts. They don't just go and grab themselves a coffee. Oh no, I've not got my ID for my cigarettes. That's not how they act. Now, Defence Sheikh at this point said he would have a much better chance of securing a lesser offence of second degree murder or even manslaughter, because both of these lesser offences carry elements of committing an act without pre-thought and or in the heat of the moment. So he's hoping that maybe that lesser charge will be brought. Now, by the 15th of November, a jury consisting of 7 men and 7 women proceeded and the trial was ready to begin. During opening statements, prosecutor Elizabeth Redinger said, beaten, bound, gagged and bagged. She said there was no indication of any sudden impulse accident, alluding to the murders as an act of premeditation as opposed to being spontaneously committed. She said that Robert's mental health had been in question, but said that the evidence may not lead to a motive and that no motive for the murders has to be proven by the prosecution anyway. She stated they were sleeping and were attacked and they could do nothing about it. she revealed that they had reached this determination due to the fact that there were no defensive wounds. And as for their cause of death, she disclosed to the jury that both Danielle and Serim were alive after the fatal beating and were still alive when they were gagged and stuffed into bags to slowly die, which is an absolutely horrifying, terrifying, grotesque thought to carry. She said both of the victims were alive. They didn't die by getting hit in the head. They died because they couldn't breathe. That slow, protracted, gasping for breath. Defence Sheikh said during his opening statements that, yeah, I'm not going to dispute the fact that my client killed Danielle and Serim. In fact, I'm going to say he absolutely killed them. But instead, what he hoped was that the evidence that he could provide would lead to a lesser degree of murder, so a second degree murder or manslaughter conviction. He said that without motive, the murders couldn't have been premeditated. And the way he approached it was to state it from the suspect's point of view. What would you have to gain by murdering the victims? So for premeditation to some degree, he'd have to potentially at least foresee some kind of gain. And yet what he does to them gives him nothing. And in fact, acts in a completely opposite direction that he is going to be found guilty of murder. So he says there's no motive and therefore I cannot believe there is premeditation. Now, a handful of people testified about Danielle and Serim's relationship. This included Serim's grief-stricken mother, Diane. She's absolutely wonderful. What a human that is, just testament to courage and to beauty and to refusing to dirty any memory of her child. Truly, she is an inspiration. The friends actually testified about trying to get in contact with Serim and Danielle on the 23rd of August, but they couldn't do. Several experts then testified about the forensic evidence that connected Robert to both of the murders. Forensic pathologist Dr. Mary Petranglou, she took to the witness stand. She was asked by the prosecutor, William Cataldo, whether the method to wrap tape over the victims' mouths and to place bags over their heads constituted as overkill. Now, she actually refused to comment specifically, but she did say it certainly ensured that it was going to happen. And she means that meant they were going to die. She said to the jury that it would have taken Robert 1 or 2 minutes of suffocation to render both Danielle and Serim unconscious, and that they would have died within 3 to 6 minutes without any oxygen. She also said that it was possible that they may have been conscious when they were suffocated. Why wouldn't that be overkill? I get that people will say, well, overkill tends to involve things like shooting somebody 30 times, stabbing somebody 50 times. But you know, if you have beaten somebody senselessly about the head, but they are still alive, and then you take time wrapping duct tape around their nose and their mouth and their neck, and you can hear them struggling because they can't breathe. Imagine what that would be like. I mean, it's hard listening when somebody's struggling to breathe in any way, shape or form. But when you're purposefully and willfully doing it and then dragging them to a shed, is that not overkill? I would argue it definitely was. Now, the jury was postponed the following morning, and the reason for that was there was a legal discussion, and that legal discussion was regarding really graphic photographs of the murder scene. So the prosecutors, understandably, they said, we want it in there. We want the evidence. We want the jury to see what this man did. But the defence sheikh opposed it. He said those photographs are unnecessary, and also they have a likelihood to be able to inflame the jury. Yes, they would. Isn't that what a jury is there for? To be inflamed by the evidence. Now, prosecutor William Cataldo, he argued that the photographs would lend themselves to the charge of premeditated murder. He said, look, these photographs depict exactly what the behaviour was. Prosecutor Cataldo ultimately did agree that he would crop the images to reduce their incredibly graphic nature. That was a halfway house they were then presented to the jury. But I'm completely on board with the prosecution. Hey, why shouldn't they see what was actually done? Now, after the final witness testified, the closing arguments were presented and prosecutor Cataldo slammed a binder against a table displaying how the full rage of Robert was on the night of the murders. He said that Danielle and Serim had no chance to survive the attack after being struck on the head with a sledgehammer. He said that Robert's actions following the murder, including cleaning up the crime scene and fleeing, was evidence that he was well aware of what he was doing. He said, nobody saw blood That's how effective a job he did. Defense shake. He maintained that he knew his client was culpable for his role in the murders, but he said that the prosecution's story of a premeditation didn't add up. He said that all of Robert's actions were in the heat of passion. He questioned why, if it was premeditated, did his client not use another weapon, such as a gun? He also made a point that if the crime was planned, why didn't he dispose of the body somewhere else, such as in the Detroit River? You know, it's interesting, isn't it, to make out that there is an even better way of disposing the bodies, even better way of using certain weapons. Can we just get real? It shouldn't be a, well, is it really premeditated he used a sledgehammer? Yeah, it's completely premeditated. You have to go and get the sledgehammer. And it wasn't one blow, it was multiple blows, and it was two people. And then it's, well, was it really premeditated when he wrapped?
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The body's up to a point where he probably thought air couldn't get in there because it was so duct taped and covered. So he thought, I've got time. It's going to be difficult to move the bodies right now. I'll just put them in the shed for a while and I'll deal with it later. But because he does that and doesn't throw them in the Detroit River, apparently that's not premeditated. No, all that happened there was the defense gave other options for dealing with a premeditated murder that was done in a different way, but would still mean it was premeditated. Absolutely, that was premeditated, even if he doesn't go as far as throwing them in the Detroit River. You can't have a bar of this is how far they had to be taken from the property and this is the weapon that must have been used if it truly were a premeditated one. The guy cleaned up the mess and he left and got a disguise. Within just 38 minutes, the jury returned with the verdict. They found him guilty of both counts of premeditated murder on November the 22nd, 2019. And on January the 14th, 2020, the sentencing took place. Poignant victim impact statements were presented by Danielle and Sarin's loved ones because Danielle and Sarin were truly loved. Diane took to the podium to provide a statement about her son. She said Sarin was a sensitive, kind-hearted person. If he saw anyone needing help, he was there. He had a knack for finding that one kid who wasn't quite fitting in, and he'd reach out and bring that person into his circle. This is the man now known as one of two bodies found in trash bags in a shed. Sarin's cause of death was suffocation. He suffered a non-lethal head wound. No skull fracture, no injury to his brain. He was knocked unconscious. He'd been suffocated with duct tape and bound, his head covered with two shopping bags as he slowly died. He was then put in two garbage bags and discarded into a shed on a hot August morning. She then spoke about the effects of this murder on the whole family. She said, each day, I struggled not to let his final day affect me more than that day. I first saw his heart beating. I say to myself sometimes out loud, you cannot keep Sarin in that day. You can't keep him in pain. Sarin isn't there anymore. The rustle of a grocery bag can knock me on my knees. I worry for my daughter's future. She fell behind in school and struggled every day. My heart breaks for her. Her view of the world around her has changed and she will soon navigate her early adult years, but without her caring, protective brother to help her along. If I'm lucky, I have another 30 years at most of learning how to live without Sarin. She has a lifetime without him. Before leaving the podium, Diane went on to say, life was ended, but his shining spirit endures. I still believe the world to be a beautiful place. Nobody in Danielle's family provided a victim impact statement. The emotions were still far too raw, and understandably so, because Danielle was killed by one of their own family. As we expect in these cases, Robert was given the opportunity to speak, to maybe apologise, to even provide some insight into the motivation behind the killing. The judge asked him, have you got anything to say? And he said, no. The judge then said, "You murdered your sister Danielle and her boyfriend Seren, and you don't want to say anything." He once again responded, "No." Judge James Bernard said, "Robert, you are an evil man and you are going where you belong," before handing him the sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge said, "An evil man is going where he deserves after murdering his sister and her boyfriend." Outside of the courts, Defence Sheikh gave some final thoughts on the case. He said, "I think that the jury has a right to do what they want. It's very hard for them to overcome what happened to the victims and the pictures that they saw. Like Miss Bryan said, the fact that they were in the shed for a while, all of that stuff just adds to the gruesomeness. In many of these cases, you always have jurors that are always concerned that if this person is back in society, what if it happens again?" He went on to reveal that he had pleaded with Robert to reveal a motive countless times, but he never got an answer. In fact, he said he wasn't even sure if a motive existed. He said, "I still don't know, and I'll probably go to my grave not knowing. That's something that's been playing on my mind over and over again." On the 31st of July 2020, Robert appealed his conviction. His appellate attorney argued that his defence attorney should have called an expert witness to explain why his mental illness prevented him from forming an intent or premeditation. The Michigan Court of Appeals denied his appeal. They said that such a defence, known as a diminished capacity defence, is banned in Michigan, which meant an expert testifying about it would have served absolutely no purpose whatsoever. But nonetheless, we expect this to happen. We expect appeals to happen and for them to be denied. Presently, Robert Majeska is incarcerated at the Bellamy Creek Correctional Facility in Ionia, Michigan, a place where he will likely spend the rest of his natural life. I'd love to know your thoughts on this one. Do you know what really stands out for me? There were two young people right at the beginning of their lives, and their lives weren't easy. You know, it wasn't financially easy for either Seren or for Danielle, but there was something truly unique about them. If you read into their history, they're both artists, creatives, they think outside of the box, and they found each other and they loved each other. And you think about the impact that these kind of quirky young people can have on our world, and it's like a ripple effect. I look at them as potential parents of brilliant children and how that's now been denied. And I asked myself, what was it that drove Robert Jr. to murder them? And I think it was jealousy. I know that that's not something we've talked about in detail, but when I think about feelings that can provoke such a rage, such an anger, such a desperate desire to snuff out the very thing they fear that they cannot achieve, when I look at this case, it symbolises that. I think Robert probably found Danielle attractive. I think he hated the relationship that she had with Seren. I think he saw their capacity for hope and change. I think he saw their drive, and it really affected him because he had so few of those qualities. And so the easiest things for him to do was to just kill it, to kill them. So he no longer had to face his own failures. They were victims in his own resentment. I'd love to know your thoughts. I'd love to know whether you think truly this is a man who's a victim of his mental health, or whether indeed, as in so many cases, he's just a man who is very evil at core, but also has mental health issues. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
The
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.